Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is Katharine Hepburn. This would normally be the part of the show where I detail our subject's life and work, but that's not really necessary here. One of the most iconic screen stars of all time, Katharine Hepburn's career spanned 60 years. She starred alongside fellow icons like Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, Humphrey Bogart, and of course, Spencer Tracy, with whom she did 9 films. She won 4 Best Actress Oscars, a feat still unmatched by any performer. As she aged, she took on more and more challenging roles, with the name Katharine Hepburn eventually becoming synonymous with fine acting. After working mostly in TV movies for the final decade of her career, she was coaxed by Warren Beatty to come back to the silver screen in 1994 for a small but important role in Love Affair, Beatty's remake co-starring his real-life partner, Annette Bening. Joining me to talk about Love Affair and the career of Katharine Hepburn is the host of the Hey Y'all Hey podcast and my pal, Erica Nicole Anderson. Hi, Erica.
Hello, hello.
I'm so happy to have you here.
I'm happy to be here. I love this podcast. And so, you know, the opportunity to talk about Katharine Hepburn, who is just a shero. I couldn't pass it up.
this is a big bite.
This
career. We can't possibly hope to cover everything of Katharine Hepburn because the career is so enormous. The legend is so huge.
Yes. But
we will do our best to kind of get our hands around the career of this amazing performer. But before we get into all that stuff, we're going to talk about Love Affair and her other films. Like, so why Katharine Hepburn, Erica? Like, what was it about her that when did you kind of latch on to her as a performer?
So as a performer, I grew up watching the old movies, the classics, and I watched a bunch of her movies. One of my favorite of her movies is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with the late, great Sidney Poitier. And I love her. I was always fascinated by, you know, I always heard my mom talk about she and Spencer Tracy. And I was always fascinated by how they did so many movies together and they were also in love. And they could do all this stuff together. But also, you know, she wore pantsuits way before it was popular. She was just the epitome of feminism to me. And so as a kid, I fell in love with her work. And her career is so vast and it went through so many changes and she was able to roll with the punches and adapt to it. She's just, you know, just a good gutsy broad, you know?
One of the interesting things I always thought about her was that how many people related to her, despite the fact that like she kind of came from this very patrician blue blood background, you know. Yeah. I mean, that voice that she had is like an accent that is sort of unknown to anything in real life. You know, never heard another person talk like that with that kind of "Hello, Spenza." You know, that kind of. That's going to be the only time I'm going to do a horrible Katharine Hepburn version. But it's amazing how she was able to connect to so many different kinds of people when you could imagine someone from that background might have a harder time with that.
Yeah.
You know, other people might be like, "God, what can I relate to these people?" Because especially in her early days, all the early films, it's funny when I go back and I watch films of the 30s, so many of them are about really rich people in like these opulent homes. And that's just the standard setting for like 90% of the movies that you find. That's not a Western. It's everybody in drawing rooms. You're like, wow, these people have unimaginable wealth. And that's sort of the standard setting for most of Hollywood movies in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I had no idea she was from Connecticut until I want to say like 15 years ago. Mm. I thought she was like a good Chicago girl, you know? and, you know, and then the whole accent, everything just kind of, or her dialect kind of all came together for me. And I'm like, oh, that's why. And then I kind of went, oh, that's why, you know. But she's just that classic. When I think about Hollywood, I think more about her than any other classic actress, even more than Betty Davis. And I love a good Betty Davis movie. But Katharine Hepburn, man, she's it for me.
Do you have, you know, you mentioned Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which again, it's, I love that movie. I love all the Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn movies. Obviously enormous chemistry because they were real life partners in some fashion. And they also just had great screen chemistry. I mean, not all real life couples have great screen chemistry. But they did. So that's the one you think of the most. Have you gone back? What are some of your other like favorite performances of hers?
Philadelphia Story was really, I don't know why it was so interesting to me, but it just was so interesting. And there's His Girl Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the title?
She's not in that one. No, you're thinking of Bringing Up Baby.
Bringing Up Baby. So I revisited that one the other day. And Bringing Up Baby, did you know, you probably did because you did a lot of research, that it didn't get a lot of love back in the day?
Yeah.
It's so interesting because I thought it was so funny. Like the their timing and everything was just so, the comedic timing was so funny. And Cary Grant being funny. Like, that's always funny in itself to me, because I just don't, I see him more of a Judy kind of, you know, and that's my horrible, you know.
Yeah, right, fair enough.
But I thought it was, you spoke about the opulence, and it was in that movie. I mean, she did like 4 or 5 costume changes a day, you know. And, I'm going to take a swim. No, I'm not. I'm going to do this. And, you know, they're looking for this leopard in the movie, and just, it was just so absurd. But the thing that stood out for me was her comedic timing. And I just didn't picture her as, you know, a funny girl. And she was hilarious. I'm like, what does this woman not do well?
Yeah, seriously. When I read a book about her in preparation for this, there's a number of biographies about her, and then she wrote 2 autobiographies. But I read one just called Kate, which is around 600 pages, and it gets into in exhaustive detail about her career. And you mentioned how Bringing a Baby was not a hit, and it always strikes me as like that we as later viewers come to these movies, you know, long after they've come and gone in theaters and they've become established classics.
Yeah.
And yet at the time, some of them were not successful.
Yeah.
And we look at it, you know, you look at her career and you see all these highlights, you know, they're like tent poles. You're like, wow, she had a couple of kind of, you know, 3 or 4 in a row that weren't big. Oh, and then there's Bringing Up Baby. Bringing Up Baby was not a hit.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, but to us, it's like, oh, that's one of the triumphs of her career. And at the time people were like, no. And one of the things that I was so struck by, and this is again what I'm talking about, like I came to Katharine Hepburn, I don't remember the first time I saw her in a movie. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner might have been one of the early ones, because I remember I got that when I worked at the video store, and I love that movie from the beginning because like, I love Spencer Tracy. I just absolutely love Spencer Tracy.
Yeah.
And like I think about her career and how many amazing films she was part of, and she tackled all this really interesting material, so diverse, and it feels like, well, that was just her career, that she just got, obviously, she met the opportunities when they came with the skill that she had, but that was, it just all, you know, it comes to me as like a finished piece, you know what I mean? Like, that's her career. Katharine Hepburn equals legend. That's just the way it is.
Yes.
And then when I read this book, it's like, no, she... And this should not be surprising to me, but she worked really hard to get those opportunities. I mean, she was a very savvy manager of her career.
Yes.
And she went after projects that said, you know what, I need something that's going to do this for me. Now, of course, she has to be lucky enough to have that material around when she needs it.
Yes.
But she had a good eye for this stuff.
Yes.
And if you look at her, you know, the beginning of her career, she does 2 films, starting in 1932, A Bill of Divorcement and Christopher Strong. Then she does a third film, Morning Glory. She wins the Best Actress Oscar for her third film.
Yeah.
I mean, talking about hitting a run right at the plate. Now, have you seen Morning Glory?
I have not seen Morning Glory. And before I forget, the movie that I was thinking about was Woman of the Year.
Oh, Woman of the Year. Okay. Okay. Yes. Oh, yeah. That's another classic.
Yes.
But in Morning Glory, she plays a struggling actress who is a little on the demented side because of how much she wants it. And by the way, for a film set in 1933, it's amazing how much the idea of fame will corrupt your personality is already established in the culture. By 1933, this feels like something that we talk about all the time now. But in 1930, she has a line in this movie where she's the struggling actress and she talks about, she's changed her name to Eva Lovelace. And she talks about how she'll change it again if anybody wants her to change it, but she thinks that's a better sounding Hollywood name. And they say, well, have you have anything in your background that's a little, do we need to worry about? And she goes, no, I'm not going to misbehave. I haven't misbehaved. I'm going to start misbehaving after I become famous and it won't matter anymore. Like, wow, this is 1933 and they're already hip to this idea that fame just F's with your head and that's why some people pursue it.
Thought,
my goodness. But so she wins the Oscar for that, right? Which is an amazing triumph to be three films into your career and you win the Best Actress Oscar. Then she does Little Women, which was a moderate success. And then she does a bunch of flops right in a row. Spitfire, The Little Minister, Break of Hearts, Alice Adams, Sylvia Scarlett, Mary of Scotland, A Woman Rebels, Quality Street, all of which did not make any money. To the point where by 1938, she was labeled box office poison, literally called that. And at some point, she decides to go off to France with her gal pal. By the way, and again, I read in this book, they talked about how there were rumors were flying that she was gay. And she did nothing to dispel those rumors. She didn't care.
Yeah, but, she's fancy.
Yeah, amazing how you could put up with that. And then right after that, she does Stage Door, which was a minor success, and then Bringing Up Baby. And of course, again, to us, that's a classic. But to her, it was just another flop along the way. And it's like, wow, like that didn't rescue her out of that. When we look at it now and you say, good Lord, any actor would be dying to have that on their resume.
Yeah. And actually, Alice Adams wasn't bad.
I've never seen that. Is that good?
I remember seeing it. Well, I haven't watched it recently, so my eye now might go, that's trash. But when I remember seeing it as a kid and or younger, I should say. And I remember it being pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, some of these movies might be good. I haven't seen them, but I mean, it's like imagine getting the Best Actress Oscar and then doing like 6-7 in a row that do nothing.
Yeah.
That has got to be terrifying because you're like, wait, what did I do wrong? You know, like what?
Do I belong here?
Yeah. I mean, so she does Bringing Up Baby. She does Holiday, which is the other movie with Cary Grant. I've not seen that one. But then she did The Philadelphia Story, which was a massive hit. She stars with Cary Grant, Jimmy Stewart, Tracy Lord as her character. I mean, it's a massive success. And then she realizes that at this point, she has to kind of adjust her image a little bit because the war is happening and she wants to kind of move away from the brash, independent woman a little bit. And she wants to settle into a slightly more traditional role. And right at that time, who does she meet? Spencer Tracy.
Yeah.
And she then subsumes her life to a certain extent to be with him and does this movie with him, Woman of the Year again, which was a massive hit. Now, for this show, I tend to want to talk about the career, not the private person, because to me, it's not terribly relevant. It's not even really even anybody's business what the private person does.
Yeah.
That said, a lot of people that regard her as this feminist icon have had trouble reconciling how much she subsumed her own wants and desires for a man who was married and would not get divorced. Mm-hmm. And from all what we've heard, you know, didn't always treat her or other people very well because of his desperate alcoholism problem. I mean, like in your mind, like, is their kind of love story? How do you feel about that as someone who, what, you know, obviously it's her choice. She made that choice to do that, but it's sort of interesting that she can retain this feminist icon persona when she did a lot of things that I think by a lot of feminists might say, that's what were you doing?
Yeah. Well, to me, that being a feminist means that she could make that choice. Mm. You know, she could have gone in the direction she was going in, but she fell in love and then she wanted to do what she could to keep that relationship strong. And by all accounts, Spencer Tracy, again, you know, we're getting a little more personal than you normally would on the show, but Spencer Tracy, he didn't live with his wife.
Yep.
And they weren't like married in the traditional sense. I think he never divorced her so that he could continue to take care of that household.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't much of a marriage, and I know that's still horrible. Mm-hmm. it's kind of a challenge to reconcile that. Like, what? Wait a minute, she was a homewrecker, but she kind of wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, sometimes the heart wants what the heart wants, and I, looking from the outside in, it looked as though their on screen and their personal life kind of overlapped a little bit because they had great success together.
Mm-hmm.
And so why not have great success personally or try to?
Yeah. I mean, I can only, he sounds like, again, I love him as a performer, but he sounds like a tough customer. He sounded yes. like he was, he cheated on Katharine Hepburn. I know he cheated yes. on his wife. He cheated on with other stars as well. I mean, yes. good Lord, the guy was just I love him as an actor, but kind of a mess as a human yeah. being. And yeah. it's just like, yeah. but yeah, it's like what you're saying about, you know, she had she was married briefly mm-hmm. to a guy named Luddy, I remember, and Ludlow, that she knew from her kind of childhood days. And again, I read in this book, they talk about that their marriage was a marriage of two friends. Mm-hmm. And it really was not particularly romantic in any real way. And then once it sort of both of them kind of decided very, you know what, this isn't really working. And that was it. That was the only ever time she ever got married. After that, she was with Spencer Tracy. And then, of course, she went on. And then after Tracy died, she went to live. She lived for another 30 years.
Yeah.
On top of it, after he went. And it was very interesting to me that one of the films they did, in fact, their second film together, is called Keeper of the Flame, which is a drama. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funny to me because to me, I feel like a lot of times in her, after he was gone, she kind of took that up. Like, she wanted to protect their legacy and yeah. his legacy as a star. And that was kind of very important to her. I mean, she yeah. did a documentary, but she wrote a book about their relationship. I mean, mm-hmm. it's interesting how she took that almost upon herself to decide to say, okay, the Tracy and Hepburn was a thing, and I'm yeah. the one here to kind of keep it in people's minds, or at the very least, tell my point of view of it from people from the outside who didn't know exactly what was going on.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't think she's less of who she was because of it,
mm-hmm.
but it's just an interesting thing and more evidence that the professional and the personal kind of intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because the first thing I think about when I think about her is him.
Hmm.
And it's probably because of the work that she did to kind of make that so.
Yeah. And she's one of those kinds of people that you could only imagine someone of her toughness putting up with him, being able to really yes. put up with him, you know, I think a yeah. lot of other people would get bulldozed
yeah.
either men or women.
But
she, you know that she is his equal in so many ways. And like, again, they were in these movies together where she was never kind of demure to him. She kind of gave as good as she got, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So she did this movie after she did another movie called Stage Door Canteen, which mm-hmm. is one of those movies. It's set in the Stage Door Canteen, and it's kind of a propaganda movie in that it was mostly done just to support the war effort. She plays herself in that. And it's so funny. The movie is 2 hours and 11 minutes, which is way too long. Way, way too long for a movie that is a lot of, it's this sort of story of the GIs, and they meet these girls, and they're about to be shipped off. And then in between, it's like, oh, look, here's guest star Ed Wynn, and he does his little bit. And here's Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen doing their bit. And oh, then wow. So she shows up at the end playing herself. And it's so funny. She looks, to me, so uncomfortable on screen because she's Katharine Hepburn.
Right.
And she's helping give romantic advice to the people in the movie that are characters. And it just looks so like, she just looks like she's like, oh, I'm here because I'm helping the war effort. But it's like, you can almost see it. And for a movie that's 2 hours and 11 minutes, she's in it for about 6 minutes at the very end of the
movie. Oh, wow.
I sat through it all. I'm going, when is Katharine Hepburn showing up in this movie? She did another movie called Dragon Seed, where she plays an Asian woman complete with the eye thing.
Yeah.
Best to leave that one alone, everybody. Yeah. then she did with Spencer Tracy, she did Without Love, another movie she did with Spencer Tracy, Sea of Grass with Tracy. She did a movie called Song of Love, and then State of the Union with Spencer Tracy, which is one of my favorites. And then Adam's Rib, which is again like one of their classics. Yeah. You've seen that one?
Yes. Yes. Did enjoy that one. And it's again one of those where I kind of imagine her between sets going, or between scenes, telling him, okay, you've had enough, put that down.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. In the book that I was reading, they were talking about that right during the end of the 40s, when the communist witch hunt stuff started and HUAC started ramping up, she was a target because she was always very liberal and she was very open about her politics. And so she ended up getting named in this pamphlet that was put out. And it's so funny because, and I guess, you know, it says something about the times that we tend to be talking about on the show. And that in the very last episode that we did about John Garfield got mentioned in this red baiting pamphlet called Red Channels.
Yeah.
And like, if you got your name in Red Channels, it was like, oh, and so she gets named in Red Channels as like a communist sympathizer.
Yeah.
And so at that time, she looked around for the kind of role that could help readjust her image as very, very patriotic, all American kind of thing. And what does she find? The African Queen.
Yeah, why not?
Where she plays this very, very patriotic American woman. Yes. And it's like, talk about the perfect film to come along at the perfect time. But she also, of course, had to have the wherewithal to know this is it. This is the script. And she goes and flies off with Humphrey Bogart and John Huston to shoot this movie, which by all accounts was an impossible shoot. I mean, just really difficult with bugs and all the creatures and stuff. But she delivered an amazing performance and it becomes one of her most iconic roles.
Yes. Yes. And did it win like a bunch of Oscars?
Yes. She didn't win, but Humphrey Bogart won for Best Actor. By the way, I did, in the book, somebody pointed out that Cary Grant, Cary Grant, but Jimmy Stewart, Humphrey Bogart, and Spencer Tracy won Oscars for Best Actor in movies with her. Bogart's only win was with her. Jimmy Stewart's only Best Actor win was with her. So
that's a lot about her.
Yeah. 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 It's like iron sharpens iron kind of thing, So after that, she does Pat and Mike with Spencer Tracy one more time. And then she works with David Lean for one of my all-time favorite movies that I think is very underrated, Summertime. Now, I know you watched Summertime in anticipation of doing the show. What did you think of it?
Okay. the tagline for the movie was, Katharine Hepburn is, you've never seen her. And she cries through so much of the movie. I went, this is Katharine Hepburn as we've never seen her. She's very vulnerable in this movie. And it was something that was very different because she's always so gutsy and so broadsy. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was very interesting. And it was also a little bit of art imitating life, I think. Because she struggled with, do I have an affair with this man who's married, or do I just keep this feeling of loneliness that I'm feeling in this country, visiting for the first time abroad, alone? And she decides to go for it. And the way she handled both that relationship and leaving, I thought, was more of a return to her persona. But it was very interesting. Like, I watched it and then immediately went to Google and read everything about the movie that I could find.
To me, that's always the hallmark of a good movie when you do
that. Yeah, yeah. I really enjoyed that one. I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah, I love movies that can take me to a place that I've literally never been, but also that I feel like I know the place by by seeing the movie, which, I mean, that's an illusion, but that's why movies work so well. But like, I don't even remember what made me watch it. I saw it a bunch of years ago, and she plays this Ohio teacher, and she's this kind of like elderly spinster sort of lady, and she's been saving up her whole life for this trip to Venice. And then she takes this trip and, you know, shot by David Lean, you know, one of the great directors of all time. David Lean, apparently, after he had shot this movie, fell in love with Venice so much that he moved there, essentially, lived a good chunk of his life there. And he himself said it was his favorite film of his own, which is amazing. Imagine the guy that directed Lawrence of Arabia and Bridge on the River Kwai is saying Summertime is my favorite movie. But you really feel like you know Venice. Mm-hmm. From this movie, the way he shoots it's gorgeous to look at. She is absolutely fantastic in it, and she has this affair with this, as you say, with a married man. And you know, this is the mid 50s. That was still not really okay to do, but the movie, you know, the production code was really weakened by that point, and you could sort of get away with that stuff. And but she has this affair with Rosano Brazzi, and because he's this kind of like romantic guy, and you know, he's very, very, very charming. Yeah. But they have this affair, and then she decides she's going to go home. She doesn't need him. Not to ruin the movie, anybody, if you haven't seen it, but it's amazingly like that she self-actualizes, and that it's like, I don't need. Yes, she is desperately lonely sometimes. You get the sense she is very, there's this little kid that she talks to throughout the whole movie, that cute little kid. Yeah. But like, she has this affair, and it proves something to herself that she's capable of this, but she's like, I don't need this guy to have a fulfilling life. And she's the one who ends it. And it's like, if you're looking at her as like this, again, like this feminist icon, that's one of the movies. Cause it's like amazing. And it's still one of her lesser known films.
Yes, I hadn't heard of it until the other day when I was kind of flipping through her movies going, okay, what haven't I seen that I want to watch right now? And it caught me, you know, Venice is one of is on my bucket list of cities. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of got my attention. And then the whole Katharine Hepburn is, you've never seen her. And there's another movie that I think we'll talk about that is, as we've not really seen her, that we'll get into that maybe.
Okay.
But that kind of drew me in, and then I watched it and I thought, wow. And you know, her, as you said, her loneliness is kind of apparent because she's, you know, wanting to have drinks with other people who are staying in the hotel, and they all have their own thing going on.
And there's lots of couples there, you know, they're couples, and she's a little bit like the third wheel for some of these couples. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I thought it was fantastic. And I immediately started telling people about it who like to watch the classics, because why didn't we know about this movie? Why didn't I know about it until now? But it was, as you said, one of her finest. And I just, it made me want to go to Venice even more. But it also it was just very, the way she handled the kid and how he kind of broke down his hard edges for her as well. And how he called her Cookie, because she called everyone Cookie. That was cute. But it was a movie that everybody should see, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really delightful. And it's just, it's wonderfully melancholy. But it just captures that. And it, you know, I've had instances where I've traveled and you just, you know, you have these experiences and you kind of know that this experience is not specifically, I've never had an affair with an Italian man. I'll say that, but it's like, you know, you're taking these trips and you have this experience and you realize that this experience can only happen in this place at this time.
Yes.
And as much as I'm enjoying it, it can never be replicated because all of these elements have to be here at this exact moment. And you can't put it together. It just happens.
Yeah.
And I love the way she interacts with the kid, as you say, because like, she doesn't talk down to him.
Yeah.
Which I find, he's like this little kid and he's like a little, he's like a, I don't know, he's like a street urchin a little bit, because he's always kind of scamming and he's selling things to people, and you don't, he doesn't have any shoes, and you kind of get the sense, is he homeless? Is he, you know, I mean, obviously his parents are fairly neglectful because he's out on the streets just all the time. But I love the way that she talks to him like an adult, like she doesn't talk, you know what I mean? I always find that to be very charming. My parents' friends, when they would visit, they generally talked to me like I was a child. And then there was one guy who didn't. And he was always my favorite because he just talked to me like I was a regular person.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. And so I love, considering she never had children of her own, and she didn't have a lot of experience being in movies with kids, in movies with other adults, she's marvelous with that little boy. And I got to think that kid is like, what? He's probably about 10. So I mean, he's 1945. So he's about 70 something. So it's like there's some, and he's still alive. So it's like there's some 70-year-old guy out there somewhere. It's like, I did school with Catherine Hepburn when I was a child.
It's great.
Yeah, it's a really, really terrific movie. And so right after that, she did a movie called The Iron Petticoat with Bob Hope.
Oh, wow.
Which is awful. I watched it. It's so bad. And it's like, when I discovered it, I was like, she did a movie with Bob Hope? Like, I can't even, what was that even like? And it's ghastly unfunny. Like, it's just, they do not mix. They do not mix. So, yeah, you can skip that one, everybody.
Oh, cool.
Then she did The Rainmaker with Burt Lancaster, which I did not say. Have you seen that one?
I have not. I've been wanting to see it, but I haven't, no.
And then Desk Set with Spencer Tracy. One more with him. And then Suddenly Last Summer with Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift. Now, I had not seen this movie until just, for preparation of the show. Have you seen that one?
I did watch it.
That is a bonkers movie.
And that is the movie I was hoping that we
would okay. Did you have any idea what you were in for when you sat down to watch it? Because I did not.
I did not. Well, I am a big Elizabeth Taylor fan as well, so I was excited about that. But I had no idea.
I mean, where to begin? I mean, it's like you've got Montgomery Clift playing a doctor, which is already like, really? Him a doctor?
Yeah.
Elizabeth Taylor is in a mental institution, and basically, if she can't prove that she's not crazy, Montgomery Clift is going to give her a lobotomy. And her mother-in-law is played by Katharine Hepburn, who is in way too infatuated with her dead son. Like she goes on and on about her dead son in a way that you're like, I think she likes him a little more than she's supposed to like.
It was a little creepy.
Yeah. And she lives in this ridiculous house with this, like, almost like a whole jungle in her backyard.
Yes.
And then she the first time we see her in the movie, she's descending from an elevator. She looks like Ming the Merciless. It's like, what? And I realized, okay, it's Tennessee Williams. And it's like, all right, Tennessee Williams had a lot of issues. We know that. And they seem to be in the foreground here for this story.
Yes. She feeds a Venus flytrap pretty early in the movie.
Oh, Lordy. Okay, Tennessee, we get it. I get it. Women are scary. All right. I know. Yeah, I think I got the point. And then Elizabeth Taylor has this whole speech, like a 20-minute speech at the end where she talks about what happened to this guy.
Yes.
And there is, like, they talk about that a guy in the movie gets eaten.
Yes.
Like, literally eaten by people. And I was people. That's what this movie is?
By kids. By young
people. By little kids.
Young boy. Young, they called them young boys.
What the?
Yeah. When I finished it, I sat and stared at the TV as the credits rolled with my mouth agape. Like, what just happened? I just saw.
I am stunned that that got made in 1959. That just, what did you think of her in the movie?
Now, that was Katharine Hepburn as we've never seen her. She was creepy, and she was kind of wicked stepmotherish, and just very, on the one hand, very warm, but on the other, very cold. And her coldness was almost evil. And it was what I sat there going, what the heck? What are you, lady? Like, what is this person? She reminded me of the mother in Flowers in the Attic. Like, like she would be that person to shove her kids in that elevator and send them up somewhere, never to be heard from again. She seemed like that person. And I thought she nailed it, though.
She is really scary, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth Taylor was amazing. Like, I understood why she did, which came first? Well, this isn't about her, but was it Cat on the Hot Tin Roof or this movie?
I think Cat on the Hot Tin Roof was before this.
Okay. Because I could see why she would do another Tennessee Williams movie or film or story, rather.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's pulpy, you know, as an actor. It's lots of stuff to sink your teeth into, certainly.
Yeah, but Katharine Hepburn, yeah, I was like afraid of her almost during this movie because her calm demeanor and her Southern accent did kind of come and go. But her calm demeanor was so calculating and cold that it was like, what the heck? And then on top of that, what kind of relationship did you have with your son? Like, lady, you're gross.
She's willing to subject Elizabeth Taylor's character to a lobotomy simply because Elizabeth Taylor's character is acknowledging and is the only one that will acknowledge that that Katharine Hepburn's son was gay.
Yes.
And that detail is so offensive to to Mrs. Venable that she is willing to have a chunk of brain cut out of Elizabeth Taylor just to silence her. I mean, it's pretty staggering. I mean, it really is. Now, I will say one thing I learned about the production of this movie. And, you know, Katharine Hepburn could be tough. You know, she could be a little on the, you know, kind of regal star side occasionally. And some of the, and again, the book I read, they detail some of the times where she could be not the most polite person in the world. But Montgomery Clift at that point had a car accident. And his nerves, when he was an alcoholic, and Elizabeth Taylor and he were great friends, and she went to bat for him. And in fact, she basically demanded that he be in the movie, even though they didn't want to put him in it. The studio didn't want to put him in it because he was kind of a risk. You know, they were worried about, can this guy really do it anymore? And apparently the director of the film, Joseph Mankiewicz, treated Montgomery Clift horribly and like insisted on long takes, and that was something very difficult for Montgomery Clift to do because he couldn't remember his lines for large chunks, and he really treated Montgomery Clift terribly and actually tried to get him fired off the movie, and Taylor, credit to her, said, if he goes, I go. And then apparently Katharine Hepburn got wind of all this and said the same thing. And sort of formed a little barrier between Clift and Joseph Mankiewicz. And the story about this is, The relationship between Joseph Mankiewicz and Katharine Hepburn was so bad that by the end of the film, the end of the shoot, he says, cut, we're done. And she says something like, is that it? Or do you need me anymore? And he goes, no, you're done. She goes, you don't need me at all on the rest of this movie? And he's like, no, we're done. And she spit at him.
Oh, wow.
Because she was so angry at him at the way he treated Montgomery Clift. And I thought, that's a bad shoot when your actor spits at you at the end of the take. I was like, oh, lordy, lordy, lordy. It's just like,
to everyone's credit, she was nominated for an Academy Award.
I mean, you know. and you know, like we're talking about it, you think about the films that she's doing in the 50s or the 40s with Spencer Tracy. Now, some of them are dramas, but a lot of them are comedies, and they're on the lighter end of things. And now we're seeing, as she's aging, she's taking on this heavier material.
Yes. You
know, and she's taking on, again, this is a particularly scary role. And speaking of scary material, the very next film she did after that was Long Day's Journey and Tonight, which is based on the Eugene O'Neill play, a 3-hour movie directed by Sidney Lumet, one of my favorite directors. And it's just four actors, her, Ralph Richardson, Jason Robards, and Dean Stockwell, as this family hold up together in their house in Connecticut as everything falls apart for them all because they all have these horrible secrets. She plays a character, Mary Tyrone, who's a morphine addict. Mm-hmm. And have you seen that one?
I've not seen all 3 hours.
I watched it, and while I will certainly appreciate its quality, it's a hard watch because it is 3 hours of people being miserable and there's no break from it.
Yes.
There's only one other character in the movie who only shows up occasionally, but it's, you know, these are four people just cutting themselves open all over each other for three straight hours.
Yes. So. Yes. It's a very hard watch. And I would always like catch it at a certain point. And then when I would see those particular scenes kind of tied to the next scenes that I'd already seen, mm-hmm. I'd go, okay, I think I understand. I'm out. Yeah. Because it's so daunting.
Oh, it really is. I mean, there's a reason why Eugene O'Neill, when he wrote it, said, don't publish this in my lifetime, because he based it on his own family. So,
oh gosh.
Oh yeah. Lordy, lordy, lordy. and the film ends on her. Sidney Lumet ends the film on her, on this tremendous speech that she has. And this was him at the beginning of his career. And here she is again, working with kind of younger directors. So then she's away from movies for about 5 years. She helps take care of Spencer Tracy during his failing health, because he was really declining rapidly. And then they get together for one last film, which is, we talked about, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Yes. And it was the last film Spencer Tracy would ever do. He died less than, I think, 2 weeks after they finished it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everyone, you know, it's great performances by the three main leads, by Katharine Hepburn and Tracy and Sidney Poitier. And she won an Oscar. She won a Best Actress Oscar for the role. And everyone remembers that speech that Tracy has at the end, where he talks. He finally changes his mind about the relationship that his daughter and Sidney Poitier's character are going to have. And then he compares it to the relationship he had with Katharine Hepburn's character. And he says something to the effect of, you know, if you have anything close to what we've had, that's all that matters. And then he looks at her.
Yeah.
And you really, I don't know, I've seen the movie a couple of dozen times, and every time I watch it, it's still, that scene still gives you chills, because you just know this is real. This is him. Yeah. This is the real people here.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a crier, Rob. and every single time, again, like you, I've seen the movie at least a dozen times. And every single time it gets to that point in the movie, I'm with her. I'm like, the tears welling up, and then they fall, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that was just amazing. And I always wondered, especially when I saw when I was younger, if he was really talking to Katharine, you know, mm-hmm. or if he was talking to, because he had to know that his health, he wouldn't be around long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He looks awful. I mean, I got to say, he was like in his 60s when he made it, and he looks like he's about 85. I mean, you're not shocked that he didn't live too long. And of course, it's helped balance out by Sidney Poitier, who was at his prime at that point.
Yes.
You know, like his absolute, apex of his influence, his looks. I mean, he just crushes it in that movie.
Yes.
He's so amazing. Now, so when did you first see that movie? Were you a little kid, or were you like a teenager?
I had to be about 9.
Wow.
My mom was a huge Sidney Poitier fan. So she still is. So, you know, we could probably do another show about him.
Absolutely. Night. Yeah.
but yeah, like his earlier films and, you know, even leading into the films of his greatest success, I just watched them over and over again. But that was one of his movies that I watched because she was in it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Wow.
But it was really like, wait a minute. I like this guy, but Katharine Hepburn, she's in color. She's not in black and white in this movie. I'm going to watch this one. And she nails it. She nails it as that mother who's, you know, she understands the love that they have, and it really doesn't matter that they're an interracial couple, and she wants her daughter to be happy. And so just her running in interference and having never been a mother, knowing how to, or showing that, playing that part successfully and believably, was just so what caught me the first couple of times I saw it. Mm. It wasn't, interestingly enough, it wasn't Sydney Poitier. Hmm. It was the fact that she ran interference the way she did. And then when they go in to have ice cream and they sit and they're talking and she's, you know, trying to figure out, you know, where do I insert this? How do I, you know, get him to understand how important this is for our kid, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just moving the way she does that, and the way the scenes that she was in until they were all together, she kind of commands the scene every mm-hmm. time, and it's just amazing.
Yeah. At 9, though, if you're seeing it, like, were you like able to kind of like follow all the politics of it exactly, or was it just? I mean, obviously, at some point I don't know, at that young an age, were you able to, like, did that part of it land on you, or are you more
I didn't get it all. The initial thing was she's in color.
Like, that was really, that was that big of a thing. Okay.
yeah, because I'd seen so many movies that, you know, the Philadelphia Story and all, they were in black and white, and so they were, you know, older films, but this is color, so this is, like, you know, close to my lifetime. and so that was the initial thing. And then, even as a kid, I was interested in a good love story. Mm-hmm. And so that got me. And then as I got older, I've always understood the civil rights part of it, because my parents were both, active in the civil rights movement. So I always kind of got that. But I think as I got older, as a teenager, I could kind of put the pieces of the puzzle together. And then as an adult, it really hit me, like, you know, this is about family, about above anything else. And this is a woman, Katharine Hepburn's character was a woman who was, you know, really wanting to preserve her family and to make sure her only kid was happy, but also that her husband could join her in supporting her daughter, their daughter. And I was a little bit older. I was maybe in my early 20s when I realized it was about family above everything else. Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It said it's a marvelous, marvelous movie, and said she won the Oscar for it. So then after that, she does The Lion in Winter, where she wins another Oscar. So she's back to back 2 years in a row, where she plays Eleanor of Aquitaine with Peter O'Toole. And uh-huh. Anthony Hopkins. It's fun to see Anthony Hopkins, like young Anthony Hopkins.
Yes.
And have you seen that one?
Yes.
Okay. And young, super young Timothy Dalton, who is about the most handsome man I've ever seen in the history of the universe. He's like, yeah, I mean, he's a good looking man now, and he was good looking when he did James Bond, but like 25-year-old Timothy Dalton, I'm like, oh, he must have just... I'm sorry.
You saying his name right now triggered it. I went, oh, that is who that was.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, and she is tremendous in this movie. Absolutely. Because, I mean, you're talking about, like, she's more outwardly evil in Suddenly Last Summer. But here it's like she's this sort of schemer in the background kind of thing. And boy, her and Peter O'Toole just are. And she plays his wife.
Yes.
Even though she's significantly older than he was, the actor, but they're kind of fudging the ages a little, because in real life, Eleanor of Aquitaine was older than Henry. But man, it's and again, color, another color movie, so you can get to see her color. But she is just, and you could see that she's. I mean, of course, this is her first movie post Spencer Tracy dying, mm-hmm. and she's moving into these roles where she is these towering, powerful figures, and. Yes. Again, they talk about this in the book I read, that like a lot of the older actresses that were of her generation, you know, Betty Davis or Barbara Stanwyck or Joan Crawford, you know, mm-hmm. they had hits here and there, but they said, unfortunately, you know, for somebody like a Betty Davis or Joan Crawford, they had to kind of do like the Baby Jane movie, which is you know, kind of like that hagsploitation thing they talked about.
Yes.
And they said, but Hepburn is all of a sudden doing this level stuff. I mean, she's doing, in her older years, she's doing Eugene O'Neill. She's doing, you know, she's doing the Lion in Winter. She's doing Shakespeare. I mean, she is now working with some of the great texts, you know, available to her. And she is bringing, she's showing what, not that you didn't know that she could do this, but it's, she's developing in a way that we very rarely get to see actresses do in Hollywood.
Yes, yes. It's almost like she went to fifth gear or sixth gear.
Yeah. It's absolutely, she's marvelous in the movie. So then after that, she does this very strange movie called The Mad Woman of Chalet. I don't know. It's C-H-A-I-L-O-T. I don't think anybody ever even says it in the movie, so I'm trying to pronounce it. That's a very weird movie. Yul Brynner, Donald Pleasence, Richard Chamberlain. She plays this kind of dotty old lady that they want to the oil companies discover oil underneath the streets of Paris, and they want to dig up Paris. And she is sort of sets them up on trial. It's bizarre. I watch it and I was like, what is this movie? Like, what is this movie? And again, like we were talking about earlier, where we come to things long after they've come and gone. Mm-hmm. And so we judge them kind of all equally. And I say, oh, she did this Mad Woman of Chalet movie. Okay, what's that? But at the time, it was a giant flop and she was knocked for it. People said, oh, her performance is very bad in manner. And she was at the time like really upset by it because she was coming after success after success after success. And she just thought, well, I'm just, you know, everything I do is great now. And then she does this thing and critics are like, this is awful. What is this piece of garbage? And she was really wounded by it. And I'm kind of amazed that at that point in her career, that still hurts.
Yeah.
You would think you would be enough to say, hey, what do I care that Pauline Kael doesn't like this movie? I'm Catherine Hepburn.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I'm, you know, Madam, you know, Queen Oscar.
Yeah, I got three Oscars at this point. What are you talking about? So then she did The Trojan Women and A Delicate Balance, none of which I have not seen either one. Have you seen either one of those?
I have not.
Okay. And then she did a couple of TV movies, The Glass Menagerie and Love Among the Ruins. Mm-hmm. She co-starred with John Wayne in Rooster Cogburn, which is the sequel to True Grit. I've not seen that one.
I've seen bits and pieces of that one. I've seen.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. And Trojan Women, I remember seeing a little bit of, and I remember not liking it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
She does a kid's movie called Ollie Ollie Oxenfree, which she admitted the only reason she did it is because she got to ride in a hot air balloon, which is funny. That's a fun reason to do it. Do a movie. I'm like, well, you have money. Can't you just hire a balloon and just go do what you do? just hire one. Get me a balloon, you know? Like, wait, I'm sorry, I did it again. So then she does another TV movie, The Corner Screen. And then here we go. You know, it's been about 10 years since the last bunch of triumphs. And here it is again on Golden Pond.
Yes.
Where she wins her fourth Oscar, the only actor ever to win four Oscars. Now, Meryl Streep has more nominations, but no actor has won four Oscars for acting. And so that's a record. I mean, maybe that'll be broken by somebody. Now, it's sort of funny to think that Meryl Streep, which a lot of people kind of think like the modern Katharine Hepburn, you know, like what name do you think of when you think of great acting? Meryl Streep. That's the name.
Yeah.
And Meryl Streep and Katharine Hepburn's career overlap by a little bit. Meryl Streep had already won her first Oscar for Kramer versus Kramer in 79. So she wins her first Oscar just as Katharine Hepburn is sort of wrapping up her career with On Golden Pond, where she starred with Henry Fonda. And have you seen that one?
Yes. That's another one where, you know, anytime I can see a scene or two, and it doesn't even have to be kind of the sadder scenes. Mm. I just immediately eyes well up with tears just immediately because I know just the presence that she had in the movie.
Yeah. It's, oh yeah.
Yeah.
She's
just amazing in it.
I was amazed to find out that I knew that she had not starred in a movie with Henry Fonda before, but they had literally never met before that. And I thought, Really? Over 40 years of living in the same town? Like,
wow.
They never even met? Like, would they not a party where one of them, you know, they would both be there? That seems so strange. And, oh, by the way, you mentioned these Oscar wins. Katharine Hepburn never appeared at any Oscar ceremony to pick up her Oscar.
She really? Didn't do it.
Never. She wow. only, yeah, she only showed up at one Oscar ceremony, and that was in the early 70s, and that was to give an Irving Thalberg Award to a producer that she was friends with. But
wow.
she never appeared to show up to get any of her Oscars, which is kind of amazing. So then she does this movie called Grace Quigley with mm-hmm. Nick Nolte. And again, can you imagine what those conversations were like at the craft services table? Like, what do Nick Nolte and Katharine Hepburn have to say to one another?
Exactly.
He plays a hitman. It's produced by Cannon Films, Golden Globus. I guess there was one week where they weren't making a Charles Bronson or Chuck Norris movies. They're like, all right, let's make this Katharine Hepburn movie. It's a very weird movie. It's directed by the same guy that did Lion and Winter. So she was friends with him. And it's about, he's a hitman, as I said, where she realizes that they meet each other, and she has all these friends that are older,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them are ill and dying, and they don't want to die slowly of this horrible disease. And so they hire Nick Nolte as a hitman to kill them, to commit kind of forced euthanasia. And it's like a great, I think it's a fun, dark idea for a comedy. It's not really well pulled off. There's even like a wacky car chase in the middle. And you're a little like, I don't see Katharine Hepburn in a car chase. Like, what? Right. You know what I mean? It just seems really undignified.
Yes.
Katharine Hepburn just running around. I think there was like a good movie to be made there, but they didn't quite make it. And then at that point, apparently she was so disappointed that that movie didn't do well that she just decided, well, I'm going to concentrate on TV movies. And she did nothing but TV movies through the 80s through into the 90s. Now,
is that why?
Yeah. She did Mrs. Delafield Wants to Marry, Laura Lansing Slept Here, The Man Upstairs, and This Can't Be Love with Anthony Quinn, all TV movies. Now, do you consider, Erica, I mean, maybe you're bothered to think about this, but like, do you consider TV movies movies, or are they're different?
Then they were different. Now it's very much the same.
Yeah. It's now it's all, much, yeah. With streaming,
yeah.
It's all.
Yeah. But back then, no TV movie was not film.
Yep.
It was a TV movie. It was Saturday movie of the week. And, you know, there's a special thing and, you know, usually it's a special actor like a Katharine Hepburn or usually not that big of a name, but yeah, and then you watch it, and you're like, oh, that was great. Like, for whatever reason, the TV movie that popped in my mind was The Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Okay, fair enough, sure. Why not?
But yeah, those weren't movies then.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way. My pal Amanda Reyes, who is the queen of the TV movie, might argue that they are movies in their own right, but I've always considered them, yeah, they're kind of separate. They're not exactly movies. There's a reason why they're designated like on IMDb as TV movies. And obviously yes. Hepburn was making a designation. These are different. And maybe because yes. it's just the quality of the film is a little different, although there are some great TV movies, of course. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not exactly the same things, but she made that choice. I just to stay away from feature films. And of course, at this point in the 90s, she's in her 80s at that point, and her health is failing. But then, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Warren Beatty, who was working on this remake of Love Affair, starts buttering her up to get her to be in this movie.
Yeah.
And he apparently really laid on the charm. He bought her a house, not bought her, but like got her a house, like right next door to where they were shooting it or something, got her like a special dermatologist.
Oh, wow.
To look after her skin or something, because apparently that was somewhat of an issue with her. And he convinced her to play Aunt Ginny in this movie. And so I'm going to get just briefly into the plot of Love Affair. Again, it's the remake of the 30s film. It was released on October 21st, 1994, directed by Glenn Gordon Caron. So ex-football star Mike Gambrell and singer Terry McKay meet on a flight to Sydney. The plane has to make an emergency landing, and so all the passengers have to wait until the plane is repaired. Even though they are both engaged to other people, Mike and Terry take a liking to one another. Terry joins Mike when he visits his elderly aunt, Jenny, Katharine Hepburn, who lives on a small Polynesian island. During this visit, they see each other in new ways and begin to fall in love. The plane is repaired and they reach New York. They decide to reunite in 3 months' time at the top of the Empire State Building. Over the course of the 3 months, each of them breaks up with their fiancés. On the way to the Empire State Building, Terry is hit by a car. Mike, not knowing any of this, is waiting for Terry, but when she doesn't show, assumes she has rejected him. He quits his job as a sports announcer and tries his hand at his first love, painting. One of the scenes he paints is of Terry when she was with him visiting Aunt Jenny. Thanks to the accident, Terry isn't able to walk, something she hides from Mike when he comes to visit many months later. As he prepares to leave, Mike mentions selling the painting to a woman in a wheelchair. When he sees that that very painting is in Terry's bedroom, he understands what happened and why Terry did not need him. Warren Beatty, as I said, plays Mike. Annette Bening plays Terry, Katharine Hepburn, and Jenny. Pierce Brosnan is Ken. Kate Capshaw plays Lynn. Gary Shandling, Kip. Chloe Webb's Tina. And Harold Ramis is Sheldon. As I mentioned, it was directed by Glenn Gordon Caron, who worked on movies like Clean and Sober, Picture Perfect, and created the TV show Moonlighting. So now, had you seen Love Affair before we decided to do the show?
I had not. Not the remake, no.
Okay.
I'd only seen the original. And then there's always that famous scene in
Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah. And the legs. And he realizes and he knows.
I cried in the Dirty Dozen. Well, who didn't?
Yes, so I had not seen it. So I was excited to really see this movie. And the thing that struck me was her voice. It's always her voice, but her now she's you know, was she 90 yet?
Or I think she was. She was born in 90. She was like 84, something like that. 85.
Yeah, but she that her voice was still very strong, and her presence was still really. She's only in a couple of scenes. But
yeah, after they leave the island, she does not come back. She's that one long sequence. Yeah.
Yeah. And her presence is felt in the entire movie when he talks about her, you know, and then they go and meet her and her presence is felt. And I took notes when I watched it in anticipation for this show. But some of the things that struck me was she talked about marriage and she said to Annette Bening's character, "I am married. He just died 12 years ago, but I'm married." Mm. So she was very much connected to marriage and how serious it was. And she didn't believe for a minute that her nephew was serious about this fiance that he had at the time. And when she's playing the piano, as the sun was setting, there was so much wisdom there. And, you know, you can't really act that. You either have wisdom or you don't, you know? And so she had so much wisdom in her eyes, and she gave them so many life and nuggets of love. And, you know, they're unlikely. She sees them before they see them.
And yes.
And they were so unlikely. Because of their situation, their lives, but she gives them so much advice, and then Annette Bening's character was just so almost arrested by this aunt, you know, and as they were leaving, she had so much concern about their future and what they were going to do going forward. And you, the average actor just can't do that. You know, she was extraordinary. And then I wrote this. I don't know exactly what I was thinking. Oh, was the semi-biographical? You know, whatever happened to those two, Warren Beatty and Annette Bening? Whatever happened? Where did they end up? Yeah, those were the notes that I took when I was watching.
Yeah, it's first of all, she got billing over the title, along with Warren Beatty and Annette Bening. It's a special appearance by Katharine Hepburn, because again, it's by 1994. It's Katharine friggin' Hepburn. I mean, it's just there's only so few of these Titanic figures still left, let alone still acting, that just getting them in the movie. And I have to think, I always think about, like, you know, people that are of later generations and then they get to do this movie. And then, like, imagine, like, I got to be in a movie with Katharine Hepburn, you know, like, wow, you know, like Glenn Gordon Caron, he's this guy who had a relatively undistinguished directing career. And then, you know, and then I think it sounds like from what I read that Warren Beatty kind of did a lot of, you know, he was technically not the director, but he did a lot of, you know, kind of heavy overseeing of Glenn Gordon Caron, let's say. But imagine just getting to be in this movie with Katharine Hepburn. And she only is in this one sequence. But first of all, the other thing I read, of course, is that it is outside of Stage Door Canteen, which I mentioned, which was a cameo. It is literally the only movie she did across 60 years that she's not the star.
Wow.
Which is unheard of. You know, someone could retain that level of heft. They are the star of every single thing they ever appeared in until this. I mean, that's 60 years. Can you imagine that? Now,
we're not even 60 years old.
I mean, it's I feel like I'm getting there rapidly, but I remember watching this movie years ago, not too long after it came out. I think I was even working at the video store when it came out, and I remembered watching it. It kind of went, and it didn't have much of an impact on me. And then I rewatched it, of course, for this, and what I remembered it being was like a glorified cameo. And it was a little like, it felt gimmicky to me. Like, all right, you wheeled out Katharine Hepburn for your movie and whatever. But then I watched it again and I was like, oh no, wait a minute. This scene is going on. This is a lot longer than I remember. And it, to me, it gave her character, her role in the story, and Katharine Hepburn's legend the respect it deserved by that. Yeah. They see each other in a different light through her eyes.
Yeah.
And she's in the movie enough. She says the F word, by the way, which is.
Yes. Fun to hear.
but the whole plot of the movie sort of turns after the appearance that the movie itself isn't the same after that. And you really do feel, especially you kind of mentioned this, Annette Bening in particular, every time Annette Bening looks at Katharine Hepburn, there's this look on her face like, wow. You know, like just this, and that's partly the character is looking at Aunt Jeannie this way, but I also think it's partly got to be Annette Bening, Katharine Hepburn, and just being like, I'm in a movie. And then near the end of the movie where they depart, Warren Beatty kisses her on the cheek, but then Annette Bening's character starts to walk away, and then she turns and just hugs Katharine Hepburn's character, hugs her, and they just let that moment breathe, and it feels like, this is, all right, everybody, the movie's going to go on, but man, we're taking pause to just, let's appreciate that Katharine Hepburn
is
still around and in this movie, and she's still bringing it.
Yeah. And wasn't that early in Annette Bening's career?
Pretty early, yeah. I mean, she'd been in movies in the late 80s, but it's still relatively new. Again, imagine just starting out and being like, I'm in a movie with Katharine Hepburn. Like
Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is pretty marvelous. Now, from what I read, unfortunately, it sounds like it wasn't the happiest shoot in the world in that Warren Beatty insisted on multiple takes and that he was warned at the beginning, like, look, you're going to get two out of her and that's it. And apparently that's generally not how he makes his movies. And she wasn't super happy with it, apparently, and her, you know, whatever, which I can understand. She's like an 80-something-year-old woman, and, you know, it's like, she's Katharine Hepburn at a certain point.
She's been working for 60 years.
I think I nailed it, Warren.
Yeah.
You know? You know.
Listen, Sonny.
Exactly. You know? But the funny thing was, I noticed she did one more movie after this, which was another TV movie called One Christmas with Henry Winkler, which I watched.
Yeah.
And that she's in that movie, and she actually has a scene in that movie with Susie Kurtz where she tells Susie Kurtz's character, I've lived my life to please only myself. I never worried about, you only have to worry about being true to yourself. And that's how I lived my life. And you can, in some ways you can say, well, that feels like a summation of her life is that scene. But it's, I feel like in that movie, it's, like you said, it's kind of like, it just feels a little kind of chintzy and just a little shop worn. And it doesn't feel like that Catherine, it doesn't, I feel like in that movie, it's not Catherine Hepburn all caps. You know, it's like, oh yeah, we got Catherine Hepburn. In Love Affair, even though the movie itself is okay, her scenes are so tremendous that to me it feels it does more of a service to her legend, even though she doesn't get like a summation the way she does in the One Christmas movie. But if, I feel like that movie, the way it was done, the way she lends weight to the proceedings, it feels like a good way to wrap up the career if that's what she chose to do. It was like, we're going to make one more special appearance and then that's it.
Yeah. I felt like her Aunt Jenny, when she passes away off screen, you feel it. Mm-hmm. Her character was that important to the movie. But The One Christmas, isn't that the Christmas Carol kind of movie?
It's based on a Truman Capote story, although I'm shocked. I'm like, really? Truman Capote wrote something this treacly? It was okay, but it just felt a little like, okay. I still look at like the fact that she specifically was like, I'm going to do these TV movies. And then she regarded Love Affair as a separate thing because it was a big screen movie. And it was, what did you think of Love Affair just as a movie by itself?
Had she not been in it, I probably wouldn't have watched it.
Yes.
Yeah. When I realized the Beatties were in the movie, I was kind of like, oh, well, huh. Well, it's for Catherine.
Yeah.
I thought it was okay. As remakes go, it was okay.
I thought the same thing. I like Warren Beatty and I like Annette Bening. I especially like her now. I think in some ways Annette Bening has morphed into that kind of Catherine Hepburn career path where she's playing older, you know, she's playing older late woman parts because she is at this point, but she's, you know, like with dignity and taking on these interesting roles and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's like, in some ways I think she's kind of going down that same route. And, but yeah, I thought it, once she exits the movie and you know that she's exited the movie, it to me, you're like, all right, okay. Yeah. Rest of this movie. All right.
Yeah. Fine. We know how it happened. She's going to get hit by a car.
But getting Katharine Hepburn in the movie again, it there is, not to be sort of corny, but it really is like magic movie dust put over that part of the movie because you just get the sense of this, you know, amazingly important person to Mike's life and the dispenser of all this wisdom. And then of course, you're knowing I'm watching a color movie in 1994 and it's Catherine. And she, you know, I mean, again, she was getting old by that point, but she had decided, I mean, she lived until 2003. So she had decided that was it. That was it. She knew that the love affair was going to be it. And that wrapped up her career. And I mean, it's, you know, there's not a lot. I think you can't look into that movie and say, oh, it's, you know, it sums up everything of her career. How could you sum up Catherine Hepburn's career in one movie anyway? It's one of the great careers ever, but I felt like it was dignified and it again, like underscored how titanic she was to films.
Yes.
And so in that sense, I was like, all right, that's a great way to go out. If you're going to do it, that's a great way to go out.
Yeah, and maybe she was like, yeah, I'm not going to have these kids telling me what to do.
Yeah, who needs this?
I'm Catherine Hepburn. Tell me what to do.
Yeah. Speaking of being told what to do, one of the things I found interesting about her was that, and you talked about her being this icon and someone who didn't take any shit from anybody, even from a young age, is her ability, like, some people can just sort of get away with it. You know, and I watched her. She didn't do a lot of TV interviews, but she did an appearance on Dick Cavett, and it's on YouTube. You can find it. And there's an intro with Dick Cavett. It's really fascinating. Where she didn't want to do it. They kept begging her to do it, and she wouldn't do it. And then finally, Lauren Bacall and another actress kind of talked her into it. And so they said, "Well, look, just come in. and we'll just do like a camera test. Like you can just be on the set and we'll just, you know, we won't shoot the interview, but just come in and you can see if you're comfortable. And if you like Dick and you like it, then we can set up the interview. So she agrees to this. She shows up, sits there on the set, and decides then and there, with no audience in the seats, we'll do the interview now. And so she and Dick Cavett do this interview in front of just the crew.
Yeah.
And then they play it back, and she allowed to be shown on television all the prep work in the beginning. So you see crew members walking around carrying shit. She comes in and she's like, this carpet is ugly, you know? And you're like, she's all of a sudden giving Dick Cavett and the crew like a bunch of crap about the set. And like,
I've got to see this.
It's so funny. You just put in Katharine Hepburn, and somebody put it on YouTube as the best interview you'll ever see, which is about right. Because it's like, she's coming in and just kind of telling them what's what. And part of me was a little like, this is really rude. Like, she's kind of coming into their house. But at the same time, it's like, she's just being Katharine Hepburn. Like, yeah. She's just kind of like, hey, you wanted me and I'm calling the shots. And that's right. How it's going to be. It's
it's fascinating. Oh, gosh. She's just fascinating. She continues to inspire and be a symbol, especially for women. She continues to be the symbol, but she was just... I keep using the word gutsy and the word broad, but she, when I think of a broad, I think of her. Mm-hmm. And it's a total compliment. It's not an insult at all. And yeah, she seemed to kind of do things the way she wanted.
Yeah. And from a very early age, you know, like not that she seemed to have that attitude before she was, again, all caps, Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah.
She came into it with that. And I think that's probably the way you probably have to be, you know, it's like you have this self-possession and that's how you're going to go through life. Cause that's how you're going to survive, especially the meat grinder that is Hollywood.
Yeah.
The only way you're going to do it is be able to just be like, have this sense of self and be like, all right, I did a bunch of flops. That's fine, but I'm going to keep pressing on and I'm going to do the work and she obviously had the chops to do it. And it's, you look at the filmography that she put together. And did you see the Aviator, the biopic? So of course, Cate Blanchett plays Katharine Hepburn in that movie because Katharine Hepburn did have a relationship with Howard Hughes.
Yes.
Cate Blanchett won the Oscar for that, which makes her the only person to win an Oscar playing another Oscar winner. That's never happened before. Now I loved her in The Aviator. Like her as Katharine Hepburn, it's probably a little more caricaturized than what Katharine Hepburn was really like.
Yes.
Because she's being written, you know, and she has all these pithy things to say. But I could have watched a whole movie as Cate Blanchett as Katharine Hepburn.
Yes, yes. She wasn't she wasn't too campy.
Mm.
It wasn't like a caricature of her.
Right, right.
Yeah, I believed she, you know, she kind of embodied as much as she could in that situation. She embodied Katharine Hepburn. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why she was the Oscar.
Yeah. I thought she was just tremendous. Cate Blanchett is great at playing real people, despite how gorgeous Cate Blanchett is. She's great at being able to kind of like, you know, again, kind of a very Katharine Hepburn type, disappear into other roles. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this, because I want to make one last segue, is that, of course, Cate Blanchett has played Katharine Hepburn and also played Bob Dylan, because she played Bob Dylan in the I'm Not There movie.
Sure
that
did.
Is my favorite part of that movie is her as Bob Dylan. I would have like preferred a whole movie of her as 1960s Bob Dylan. But the reason I bring that up is because, and this is like the last little fun factoid that I found when doing my research, was during the 70s, in the early 70s, Katharine Hepburn lived in New York. She was living in New York in like Greenwich Village, or maybe not Greenwich Village, but somewhere in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
And her neighbor in the early 70s ended up being Bob Dylan, because he moved back to New York in the early 70s. And there is this thing somebody found, a note that Bob sent to Katharine Hepburn and said, we're having a party for my daughter next door tomorrow. So there probably will be a lot of noise and a lot of people. And I just want to let you know that that's what's happening. And then he adds, if you could come by, we would dearly love to see you. Now, there is no record as to whether she showed up or not, but I want to tell myself that she did. Because
I
want to
say she did, yeah.
Because I maybe want to imagine Katharine Hepburn and Bob Dylan
yes,
together, just hanging out. Yeah, how are you doing, Kevin? Oh, Bob, I really love that. You know, like, I can't help but doing it. I just want to imagine that two people of that Titanic level of fame were like sharing a birthday cake or something. You know, I want that to be true.
Yes, she came over with something nice for the kids.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Exactly. I made a pie, you know, like, okay. I got to stop myself. I'm really doing this over and over again. But yeah, I want that to be true so bad.
Yes.
The idea that they hung out together, even for 10 minutes. It's just,
yes.
It's amazing. So, well, I mean, again, we do our best to kind of cover all of the career here, but it's so hard when it's Katharine Hepburn. Yes. As we're wrapping up here, was there anything in the movies that you watched that you said you watched Summertime? Like, is there anything that you discovered about her that you were like, I'm surprised at that. I didn't know that. I didn't know that angle of her. I didn't know she could do that kind of thing. Was there anything that you learned that was new to you about what you already thought about her?
I have to say it was suddenly last summer that I was so taken aback, and I just finished it last night.
Oh, wow.
So it's still fresh. I was so taken aback by the character, and she just, like, I see her as like Auntie Kate, you know? Mm-hmm. and she was someone I didn't know. I didn't recognize her in this movie. Mm-hmm. And that was, it was kind of the cherry on top for me. Like, that is why she's the Katharine Hepburn, you know, this kind of role.
That she could do something that different.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a craziest movie. It's a craziest movie. Yeah. I really enjoyed seeing, again, some of these movies, some of these things that I've never seen. I always wanted to see The Lion in Winter. I never had. And I was like, oh, I'm really glad. Our Long Day's Journey into Night. And just like, even seeing Iron Petticoat, which is not good, but I was just like, wow, seeing her with Bob Hope is just surreal. So
to see it just so I can hate it.
Oh, it's just, you know what? It's just, it's not even like you hate it. It's just not funny. Okay. And it just plods along, and you're like, oh my God, how much more? 80 more minutes. Like, what? You know? So I would go watch something. Try something else. Go watch Summertime.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Don't waste your time.
Gladly.
Yeah. Oh my Lord. So, well, of course, everybody listening, if you have a particular favorite Katharine Hepburn movie, leave it in the comments on our website, vinewaterpodcast.com. I'd love to know what you think of, again, the amazing thing about Katharine Hepburn's career is like you could say you've seen a dozen Katharine Hepburn movies, a dozen. And that's still like, well, like you've seen, you know, that's like scratching the surface of the career.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I thought I'd seen a lot of her movies. And then I was like, I haven't seen that one. 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 Yeah, I was like, God, wow. I've only seen some of her Oscar-winning performances. That's crazy. Yeah. You know, unbelievable. So, well, Erica, thank you so much for doing this. You know, I enjoy talking movies with you, and I really enjoyed digging through the history of Katharine Hepburn. So this was just great. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
I am on Instagram at Hey Y'all Hey Podcast. And I am on, well, I don't use the Facebook that much. Let's say Instagram. And then you can hear me on Spreaker and anywhere you listen to podcasts. And that's the Hey Y'all Hey Podcast with Eric Nicole Anderson.
Why don't you tell people a little bit what that show's about?
It's about current events. And I've actually taken a couple of weeks off. So I'll be recording a new episode tomorrow. But it's a current events. So I talk everything from music and movies and TV to politics. And I like to pick on certain politicians who don't say very smart things. I'm looking at you, what, North Georgia? I'm not going to say your name on the podcast. But, But I'll have a lot to talk about in this next episode with the SCOTUS nomination and how she was treated during the Senate hearings, and a lot about, you know, I've tried not to talk too much about COVID, but I've talked about COVID. And then one of the fun things that was an ongoing kind of recurring comment was on space and interterrestrial or extraterrestrial beings, and the fact that the DOJ or DOD finally admitted that there was some kind of weird space, you know, travel going on. And so I kind of talk about that a little bit. And it's just kind of a melting pot, a potpourri of things, if you will.
All right. Very cool. Yeah. Check it out, everybody. So, and of course you can find back episodes of this show on our website, as I mentioned, finewaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show in any podcatcher of your choice. You can follow the show on Twitter at @FadeOutPod. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be named checked on a show of your choice. So if you love Fade Out, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. So that's going to do it. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script, so it's time to fade out.
Go.
Yes. May I?
Thank you. Thank you. I wore this when I was married.
Beautiful.
Well, off we go. These petals are supposedly the hands of a Polynesian princess. It's been hanging around for 62 years and is still holding together. I wish I could say the same for myself.